The second case set for oral argument this morning is appeal number 30773, Amber Furick versus Bruce Hagen et al. We have Kylie Schmidt, who is arguing on behalf of the appellant Furick, and Ryan Redd, who's arguing on behalf of Appalese. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Schmidt, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, council, yellow jackets, and members of the community. For over 70 years, this court has applied the same common law negligence standard for livestock automobile collisions in this state. This flexible, circumstance-specific standard dictates—
Maybe just a bit soft. I don't know if you need to get closer to the mic or
sure.
Maybe speak up a little bit.
This flexible, circumstance-specific standard dictates that a jury of one's peers, not a judge, must decide whether defendants breached their duty of care to keep cattle off of roads and people in this state safe. There's no reason to change the standard at this time. The trial court below erroneously granted summary judgment and dismissed plaintiffs' claims of negligence and negligence per se. This decision was incorrect for three reasons. First, the trial court applied the wrong legal standard on plaintiffs' negligence claim with respect to whether defendants breached their duty of care. Second, the trial court improperly weighed the evidence and failed to view that evidence in the favor of the non-moving party, here the plaintiff below. And third, the trial court erred when it dismissed the negligence per se claim by conflating the common law negligence per se claim with a claim that arises exclusively from statute and creates an independent right of private action. To correct the errors below, appellant respectfully requests this court to reverse and remand this case back down to the trial court on all issues, allowing the plaintiff to proceed to a jury trial. I want to first start talking about the legal standard applied to these types of cases. And this gets us back a bit to tort law 101, duty, breach, causation, and damages. We're addressing the first two here. And appellant does not contend that the trial court below erred in determining that, yes, there was a duty of care owed by the defendants in this case. So that's removed from this issue. We don't contend that was error. Where the problem started is the breach of that duty and whether the court appropriately determined the breach duty there. And as this court previously said in Casillas, landowners and livestock owners have a duty of care related to their animals. So we can discard the first part of that tort 101 and move on to the breach component. Whether a landowner or livestock owner could have reasonably anticipated the danger in light of all the facts and circumstances, that's what we're dealing with here. And the case law provides what needs to be considered: the facts of the case, the character of the road, the kind of traffic, the time of day, and all other pertinent facts and circumstances. But the trial court here didn't apply this standard. Instead, it created a novel two-pronged approach that did a stepwise analysis that was inconsistent with the law. And as the court order states, and this is page 744 of the record, step one is showing that defendants reasonably anticipated that livestock could get in the road due to all those facts and circumstances. And then, and only then, if the livestock does get on the road, whether the landowner could reasonably anticipate injury as a result.
Isn't that really not something that's not in dispute here? I mean, it did not appear that the Hagens disputed the notion that this is a very busy highway with lots of traffic, and if one of our cows escapes, there is a danger there. It seemed like that's not the issue here. The issue goes to, really, it's really about the maintenance of the fencing, isn't it?
You're correct that ultimately the testimony of the Hagans was that this is a busy highway. There's truck and trailer traffic, and we know that injury can result because it abuts Highway 11. Instead, they contended that there's other facts and circumstances here that we could never have known this possibly could have happened because of all the facts. So let's dive into those facts a bit, because this court does have to review this de novo and look at all those facts. We have the evening of October 12, 2019, plaintiff driving northbound on Highway 11, about 20 minutes northeast of Sioux Falls. We know the most populous city in this state. And the road traffic there is heavy, and unfortunately is known that if cows escape, injury could result. So looking to the other factors, the surrounding conditions, I want to make it clear, this is not just a case about negligent fencing. Plaintiff did contend that the fence was not appropriately monitored. Plaintiff did contend that it was not appropriately maintained. However, the evidence also supported an issue of negligent pasturing. Now, the facts below show that there's a rotation of these cattle in various pastures around the area where this occurred. And it happens seasonally, depending on how times of year and that kind of thing. And typically, the defendants in this case would rotate the cattle off of the subject pasture that surrounds this bridge and this roadway in late October or early November. But the evidence shows below there was catastrophic and historic flooding that happened shortly before this incident occurred. The evidence shows that there was extensive fence damage, and in particular fence damage abutting the roadway, right where this bridge is, right where that flood from
Spillet Rock breaks. Is that damage, or is that testimony coming from your expert?
No, that testimony is coming from the Hagans themselves. There's also photographic evidence in the record of the extensive flooding obtained during discovery in this case.
But he also testified that he checked the fence the morning before the accident, checked it after the accident, and the next morning after the accident, saw no issues. Is any of that testimony disputed?
So we do dispute that there was appropriate monitoring of this fence.
No, I understand about monitoring, but we've got this testimony from the landowner or the owner of the cattle saying, I checked them that morning, I checked them after the crash, I checked them the next morning, the fences were fine, no open gates. Is there anything in the record to dispute that testimony?
There's evidence to dispute that that was appropriate, and here's where it is, Your Honor.
But as to the condition of the fence, no dispute?
No, there is dispute about the condition of the fence, and that comes through expert testimony.
And that's the condition about 2-3 years after the fact?
That's not correct. So there is circumstantial evidence through our expert testimony that this fence was the most likely explanation for what happened, is this fence was in disrepair. And that is based upon the topography of the land and the admission from the defendants that this fence was in a state that needed extensive repair shortly before this.
They admitted that they needed to repair the fence, and then there was also testimony from Bruce Hagan that they did repair the fences, and there was an exhibit provided that showed the actual areas near this highway where the fences were repaired. So I didn't see anything in the record that disputed that. Am I wrong on that?
You're correct that there was an exhibit with the dots that shows where the fence was repaired, according to defendants, after this occurred. What we don't have in the record is when those repairs occurred. There was no documentary evidence of that, and the defendants did not recall. when those repairs took place.
Well, but from the other testimony about him checking the fence on the day of the incident, I mean, it appeared apparent from the record that it was before that.
Well, appellant disagrees with that, and I do want to point out this issue of the fence itself. A defendant testifying that a fence is in appropriate shape and good condition is not the end of the analysis. That is not the death of a case in this circumstance. The other side has the ability to rebut that through expert evidence, through circumstantial evidence, and through claiming, hey, it was dark at the time that you claimed to look at this fence. There's topographical changes of this fence. You have these lights that flash when the electrical components of the fence are in working order. And even when those are flashing, our expert has explained that that doesn't mean that the high tensile wire that is electrified is appropriately positioned, okay? And so using that evidence and reaching this expert conclusion that, yes, the most likely explanation is this cow got out. And I'll direct the court to, in wrestling with this issue, a past case. We have cases before this court has determined where there was no conclusive determination of how a livestock got out, okay? And the case I'm addressing right now, there was expert testimony on both sides saying, yeah, the most likely explanation here is that a gate was left open. The defendants were the last ones to check the gate. The gate, they didn't find any open gates. They didn't find any damage to the fence, but the livestock got out. That's very similar to what happened here. Defendants were the last ones to check this fencing. They didn't find any evidence that this fence was in disrepair. But given the circumstantial evidence we have, given the expert testimony saying, yes, this is how the cow escaped, more likely than not, that can be used to rebut that evidence.
So here it doesn't seem that anyone was suggesting there was a gate left open. It was your expert's opinion was had to do with whether or not the electric wire, the backup electric wire fence, was at the proper height in combination with what you are suggesting is that the barbed wire fence is in poor condition. Is there we still have to apply a negligent standard, right? So a reasonable standard of ordinary care. So I didn't see that was really necessarily addressed with the court. So this isn't a situation where there's an allegation of no maintenance of the fence, but essentially it wasn't good enough, or that's kind of what I understood your argument to be. He should have been, I'm not sure what the suggestion is, checking the exact height of this electric wire every day, or what is the ordinary care standard in a case like this?
Sure. The ordinary care is when there are circumstances like those here, where there's extensive flooding, there's wet ground, and flooding that ravaged this fence right along the bridge where this happened, that there needs to be more vigilant monitoring than typical without those conditions.
Okay, so the testimony was he did it twice a day, which did not, there didn't seem to be anything to dispute that. And so that wouldn't meet the ordinary care standard or sufficient to show that it was, go ahead.
Sure, and no, in this circumstance, just looking at those fencers and those lights, given all of these conditions, is not sufficient. Because those lights are flashing, does not mean that the fence is appropriate. And we did rebut through evidence of when the sun set and raised that the purported claim that this was checked all of these times was times when it was dark out. And so that's circumstantial evidence to rebut the appropriateness of this monitoring. And through that expert testimony, we were able to show that, hey, they claim this, here's how we rebut it, through expert testimony, and also this, the standard of reasonableness. A reasonable juror could find, given all of this evidence, that it wasn't done appropriately. A reasonable juror could, when viewing all this evidence in plaintiff's favor, determine not to believe the testimony of the witnesses and the information there, and instead rely upon the expert witness testimony. And although this is a challenging circumstance where there is no direct evidence or photographic evidence of that fence that day, there is enough there to surpass summary judgment.
It's interesting, you know, and I know you're out of time, can I just make this comment? It's more of a comment than anything else, because our cases are legion in saying that a non-moving party can't resist summary judgment based upon conclusory allegations. Your argument here seems to flip that a little bit and say that a moving party can't support a motion for summary judgment with just bare self-serving allegations, and that there is, under the standard that's contemplated in our cases, a sense that we have to discount that if there's some plausible explanation that suggests it may not be right, and we have to infer, based upon the evidence, the facts, and the light most favorable to you, the non-moving party. Sort of?
Yeah, certainly. And while this isn't a case where, say, the sham affidavit rule or whatnot was raised below, yes, the self-serving testimony of a party standing alone, it is kind of a flip-flop here.
Maybe. Huh.
Perhaps.
I just thought about it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Mr. Redd, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. There's two fundamental issues, matters at issue in this appeal that relate to civil litigation. The first, as it relates to the jurisdictional issue that was raised in the appellee's reply brief, concerns the fact that the rules of civil procedure are not discretionary, they're mandatory. The second fundamental principle of civil litigation is that in order to avoid summary judgment, the plaintiff must present evidence to support their claim, enough to at least garner a question of material fact. With respect to the first issue, the jurisdictional issue, I'll touch on it briefly. Civil Rule of Appellate Procedure, Rule 23, requires the cost of appeal bond to be filed. It states that the cost of appeal bond shall be filed within the timing provided to notice your appeal. The plaintiffs had 30 days to notice their appeal from the entry of the order, from notice of entry of order. The deadline to file the notice of appeal and file that bond expired on July 25th, 2024. That deadline came and went without the cost of appeal bond being filed. And there's really been no justification as to why that was not done. There was inference that it was because counsel for the defendants, myself, had sent an email advising that the plaintiffs didn't need to satisfy the judgment that was obtained on the taxation of costs while the appeal was pending. That was a courtesy that was sent as it related to enforcing the judgment, which the judgment party is entitled to do unless...
Regardless, your argument is it's jurisdictional. We've certainly said it's jurisdictional. If you don't file your notice of appeal timely, you don't get the notice of appeal served. That's jurisdictional. Do you have any cases where we've said it's jurisdictional to not post the appeal cost bond?
The specific rule, Rule 23, has not been addressed by any case that I found.
What about SCCL 1526A4, which lists the requirements for an appeal, and among them are the notice of appeal and a docketing statement, but it also contains a provision at the end of that statute that says failure of an appellant to take any step other than timely filing the notice of appeal does not affect the validity of the appeal.
Right. Well, I would note then that going back to Rule 23 on that point, which uses the word shall file.
This is a statute.
Correct. There should be some, at the very least, they should be able to be interpreted together. There's no reason if under that statute would mean that the notice or the cost of appeal bond was unnecessary, then Rule 23 of the Civil Rules of Appellate Procedure probably should just go out the window, because if the filing of the bond's not mandatory, the timing's not mandatory, why have the rule in the first place? And so that was a issue that was raised. I wanted to address it.
I should correct myself. It may be a statute that has one of those backgrounds that's also been amended by our court.
There you go. And I don't have it in front of me to address it specifically, but at the very least, the rule has a timing requirement. The Civil Rules of Appellate Procedure has the requirement for the cost of appeal bond. It wasn't filed. It wasn't filed on time, I should say. I think it was filed about a month ago.
What about the plaintiffs, the sufficiency of the plaintiff's theory? Do they have to solve this case in order to survive summary judgment, or could they rely upon circumstantial evidence or other types of evidence, or do they really have to go in and solve the case?
They don't have to solve the case. That's never been a standard that's been presented for summary judgment. The standard is always required there be evidence to establish each of the elements that the plaintiff bears the burden of proof. Now, this is a negligence action, which would require the plaintiffs to present evidence that the defendant was negligent. Their complaint asserted that the negligence was due to the failure to maintain the fencing. The plaintiffs haven't presented any evidence that the fence wasn't being maintained appropriately. It wasn't in anything other than good condition. So that's the shortcoming of the plaintiffs in this case from an evidentiary perspective, is they don't have any evidence.
But counsel, in Casillas, we determined that the issue of breach, including the foreseeability of the danger in light of the circumstances, was a fact question for the jury.
Correct.
Well, what's different here?
So there's a couple things. I'm glad you raised this question, Justice Stern. Here, as we noted before, I think it was Justice Devaney asked, there's no contention that the defendants had a duty to restrain their livestock. There's no dispute that the livestock, the cow that escaped in this case, escaped. It wasn't allowed to roam free. It got out. In the cases, the Casilla case and the previous cases from the South Dakota Supreme Court, they reversed summary judgment because evidence was presented that the defendant was on notice that either its animals were running at large and shouldn't have been, or that an escape was foreseeable. In the Casillas case, the evidence was presented that the defendant had previously put its bull in a corral with another bull, and the bulls fought, and the bull at issue, the one that ended up getting hit by a car, had escaped. Fast forward, I think it was 2 years, the defendant put that same bull back in the same type of corral with another bull. They fought, it escaped, and the defendant never went back and checked on it before night to make sure it was still in the enclosure. So this court, and Justice Sabers, in his decision, indicated that the evidence that the defendant was on notice that there was a condition that would make it more likely that the cow would get out was evidence to show, to create a question of fact, that the escape could have happened.
Well, but when we talk about notice, you know, one of the things we look at is we also look at the highway, the feature of the highway. So you're looking at Highway 11, busy thoroughfare in Minnehaha County. Does that rancher, that cattle owner, have is there a different level of reasonableness based versus, say, a county or township road in Harding County, where maybe there might be one or two cars a day that go by that pasture, versus Highway 11, where there's probably hundreds of cars that drive by? Does that reasonableness look different in those two contexts?
It does in some regard, and I'll note that the characteristics of the highway initially in the Exenberger case was addressed as to whether it was reasonable to allow the cattle to run at large, or livestock as horses in that case, to run at large, where there was evidence to suggest that the defendants had allowed their cattle to run at large. In this case, it's undisputed that we didn't allow the cattle to run at large. It's undisputed that the type of fence used was appropriate for the location. So it's not a case where there was, you know, one strand of barbed wire next to a really busy highway. That's not good enough. The question as to reasonableness, I think, as I understand it, has to do with how often maybe you should check this fence. It's important to note, this property is directly across the street from the defendant's house.
Would that extend to how you check the fence?
Would that extend to how you check the fence, not just how often?
I think you're starting to split hairs in that regard. You've got the appropriate type of fencing in place. Barbed wire fencing is no state-of-the-art type of material. One of the inherent things with barbed wire fencing is it's not fail-proof, it's not infallible. It's recognized in a number of the cases from the agricultural states surrounding ours, recognize that cattle can escape even a perfectly maintained fence, an appropriately maintained fence. So checking the cattle, checking the fence every day, if it's a busy area, probably would make sense. But to say it's so busy, you have to check it more or less.
But my question is about, does it extend to the nature of the checking that you engage in? So as I understand it, the plaintiff's expert, disagreeing with the discussion that Justice Salter had with plaintiff's counsel, where it was about whether the jury would choose to believe that Mr. Hagen had, in fact, checked the fence twice a day. The expert wasn't disputing that. The expert was saying, if you check it twice a day, you have to check it in an appropriate manner. Simply going and looking to see that there's continuity in the wire and electricity flowing down the line is not sufficient. The expert says, in these circumstances, flooding and possible damage to a fence, his opinion was that you need to walk the fence or you need to ride the fence, which Mr. Hagen said he did not do.
And I don't think Mr. Hagen necessarily said he did not do that. Mr. Hagen said he checked the fence. He ensured the posts were upright, the barbed wire were taut, and that the electric fence was electrified and generally in the correct location. Important thing to note, twofold, with respect to how often you should check it. Again, Mr. Hagen testified he checked it the morning and the day, in the evening before dark. So even if he checked it once a week, he checked it the one time that was important and relevant to this case because he ensured it was in the correct shape. And as for the how well you should check it, the fence was operating as intended. The barbed wire fences, the five-strand barbed wire fence plaintiff's expert testified alone was sufficient to restrain the cattle. It was appropriate for the area. So to say, well, maybe the electric fence wasn't checked good enough, well, he's already acknowledged that that was overkill. That was more than enough. The five-strand fence alone was sufficient, which Mr. Hagen testified was upright, the posts were in place, and the wire was tight. You can see that when you drive by. You see a fence and the wires are droopy and loose. It's obvious. So he confirmed that it was working as intended tonight at issue. And to just touch on the question that Justice Salter had asked Ms. Schmidt, I don't think there's any grounds to discredit the testimony of the person with firsthand knowledge in this case. Bruce Hagen is a person boots on the ground. He's there every day maintaining the fences, checking the cattle, making sure everything is as intended.
So there's also testimony in the record that he checked the fence 2 to 3 times a week. Does that change the analysis or the outcome if it's 2 to 3 times a week versus twice a day?
Right. The question, I think, in general was, what's your general practice? What do you generally typically do? And he said, well, typically, I will drive the fences twice, 2 to 3 times a week. Something to that effect is what he said. He testified that on the day at issue, he had checked it that morning, and then before dark, he checked it again, the cattle were in. So I don't think how often he checked it matters, considering that he checked it on the day at issue. And I'll note, as it comes to, you know, the foreseeability aspect, this court's tackled that question in other context involving liability for animals. In the dog bite cases, this court has repeatedly said that just because a dog bites someone doesn't mean the owner's liable. The plaintiff has to present evidence that that bite was foreseeable. They've got to present evidence that the owner of the dog knew that the dog had dangerous propensities or that there was other facts to indicate that that bite might occur. The same analysis applies in this case. The plaintiffs have to present evidence that the defendant had noticed that these cows would escape or could escape. Beyond the mere fact that a cow can get out of a maintained fence, the defendant has to have done something or known of something and not addressed it. And there's no evidence in this case that the defendants were on notice of any issue.
So if there's a non-speculative, theoretically, if there's a non-speculative, plausible theory that explains why this cow was on Highway 11, do you still win this motion or do you lose it?
When you say non-speculative, I'm sorry to...
Non-speculative. It isn't speculative. It may not be direct, but it's not a speculative theory. It's a plausible theory about why this cow is out on Highway 11. Do you still win?
Not if it's not based on any evidence. I think we win. Yes, we do, because there's
no... Do you win based upon the strength of Mr. Hagen?
I don't think we win on the strength of the evidence. As this court's summary judgment isn't based on the weight of the evidence or the strength. It's based on the evidence is that they are not. And to that point, if someone was able to say to a degree of admissible testimony that this cow got out because the defendants did something wrong, not just they got out because this is how it got out, but it was because it was the defendant's fault, then possibly. But that's not what this case has. As is noted, plaintiff's expert says, if you review his report, it's the most likely way that cattle typically get out is because the gates left open. But there's no evidence that any gates were left open, so the next most likely way is that the fence isn't maintained well enough. So based on that probability, that must have been what happened, and let's see if we can't reverse engineer an outcome. Well, that's not appropriate. It's a pure probability opinion. It's not tied to any evidence.
Other than the cow being where the cow shouldn't be.
Correct. And as the courts across the Midwest, and I would suggest this court would probably recognize that just because a cow is out isn't evidence of negligence. And the cow can get out of an enclosed pasture, whether it's jumping the fence. It's a sentient being. Again, just like the dog. A dog can bite under the right circumstances. A cow can escape a barbed wire fence. It's a cost-effective means to restrain cattle, but it's not perfect.
So you're saying a cattle out on the road, that if that alone provides for liability or creates a question of fact, really becomes, we're really talking about strict liability in that point rather than reasonableness of the actor. Do you agree?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And that's not what, if someone's going to impose strict liability, it's the legislature. And that's not, we could be shocked if in an ag-based state like this, where cattle farming is such a huge part of our economy, that they would make that step. They haven't. And so that ties back to, it's a negligence case. The plaintiffs had to present evidence that the cow escaped due to the negligence of the defendant. And they had every opportunity to do that. All the plaintiffs in the livestock cases this court had previously issued presented evidence that the cattle were out beforehand or in the days before, the month before. Plaintiffs drove by this property every day for 18 years. She drove by a half an hour before dark and didn't see any cows out. She was there for an hour after the accident, didn't see any cows out, didn't see any issues. And she drove by the next day and never saw any issues. Plaintiffs presented no evidence. They had every opportunity to do so. It's no different than the dog bite cases. And for those reasons, we would press that the circuit court's decision be affirmed in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Redd. Ms. Schmidt, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
One of the things the defendants failed to do in this case was rotate the cattle off of this pasture when this flooding was happening. They did so 2 days after this
happened. Is that an argument you raised below? I don't recall seeing that.
It was raised below during the hearing, yes. It was addressed during my argument in the motions hearing. They had an opportunity to do so, and typically usually weeks after this, they would bring those cattle back to the home place for the winter. But rather than doing that early when all this catastrophic flooding occurred, those cattle were left in that pasture when that fence was completely underwater, and as the defendants testified, it was creek bottom in that pasture. And they did not do that.
Getting back to our standard that we talked about just a few moments ago, that allows, requires us to draw all reasonable inferences in your favor as the non-moving party, the powerful and really significant part of that formulation is reasonable inferences. In our Godby decision and others like it, we've emphasized that. You know, it's not just that you can infer this under some set of circumstances that you can kind of put together and line up. They have to be reasonable. And in fact, in Gabi, we sort of said it can get a little attenuated when you stack an inference on top of an inference and it becomes potentially less reasonable. Is that what we have here? Is your theory really stacking an inference on top of an inference and having multiple layers of inferential sort of review for the court?
No, Your Honor, we don't believe so. And I do want to take the opportunity to address Godby briefly. In that case, there was an actual photograph of the grate at issue without these crossbars. And there was also an expert from the city hired in that case to say, no, there's no evidence that this grate ever previously had these welds that they believed were safe. The plaintiff in that case had no expert.
Had what, I'm sorry?
No expert. And that case is different because the plaintiff had to establish that that grate was damaged, okay? We do not have to establish in this action that the fence was in a particular condition on a particular day in order to win on summary judgment, because we have this totality of the circumstances analysis here where all these factors need to be considered to ascertain what was or was not reasonable. And so as I said earlier, we have this the ability to take these cattle off of this pasture to keep motorists safe when this flooding occurred. That was raised below. That's part of this totality of the circumstances analysis, independent of any fence maintenance issues, fence monitoring issues. There is evidence here under this multi-factor analysis that would allow a jury to say, yes, it was reasonable under these circumstances to take these cattle out of this pasture, because as defendants admitted here today, sometimes these cattle get out and there is no explanation. That's foreseeability, if I've ever heard it. We should not be in a position where a plaintiff is the only one that has to have personal knowledge to rebut evidence presented by a defendant. And I raise this example in the brief below, but I think it's also helpful here. A medical malpractice action, surgery, plaintiff unconscious, doctor makes a mistake. Doctor testifies, I did everything appropriately, did nothing wrong. The plaintiff is never going to have personal knowledge about what occurred during that procedure to be able to say, actually, that's not how it went. So what plaintiff saw and observed for however many years is not the only evidence that can be used to rebut these statements by defendant. Plaintiff has the ability to retain expert witnesses and use other evidence to rebut material.
So your expert testified.
Your expert testified, or he gave his opinion about the nature of the inspection that should have occurred. Did anyone give any indication anywhere that it was that factor, failure to do that type of inspection, that actually caused this cow to escape? So you started out your discussion, I believe, with a torts 101. So we have duty, we have breach of duty, we have causation, and we have damages. So this is the causation part. So he may have testified about breach of duty. He didn't conduct the level of care inspection that was necessary. But did your expert say anything about, and that absolutely led to this? Because as I read the record, there's no evidence there about actually how the cow got out.
So if I may respond, the expert did testify as to material that could go to both duty and breach, did testify the most likely path, which I contend is a causation piece, was through an area of the fence where it was in disrepair and the high tensile wire was not appropriately maintained. However, the issue of causation is not before this court. The motion by defendants below only addressed the breach of duty component of that torts 101 piece. So while I believe the expert did address that between his deposition testimony and the affidavit submitted in our opposition to summary judgment, I do not believe that causation component is appropriately before this court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.